Hey everybody, this is Zoe and Allie from the What is Social Practice Art course in NYU's Art Education and Community Practice program, and you're listening to our Lower East Side Community Hero podcast, the show that gets you to know Lower East Side's community members who have received a Community Hero Award to recognize their deeply meaningful contributions to the neighborhood. Today we are talking about creative practices with Jan Lee. Jan Lee is a third-generation Chinatown resident and community organizer. Jan is a leader in organizations such as the Chinatown Core Block Association, a group of residents, property owners, and business owners, addressing quality of life issues and support of enterprises that positively contribute to the lives of Chinatown residents, and Neighbors United Below Canal, working to push against Mayor de Blasio's proposal to build the tallest jail in the world in Chinatown. In addition to his work as an activist, Jan formerly owned an antique store in Brooklyn, manages his family's properties, and does work in contracting and woodworking.
Tell us about your work in the Lower East Side.
So, it's funny that you say Lower East Side because there are some people that don't even consider Chinatown Lower East Side, but I do. It is the lower part of Manhattan, and it's on the east side. So, I started community organizing, I guess, when I was quite young. Even during the Koch administration, there were people that wanted to turn Chinatown into a pedestrian mall, like in the suburbs, where they just close everything down and plant trees and pave the streets over and really sanitize our community to no longer really be an authentic Chinatown. They kind of wanted to turn it into a Disneyland version of Chinatown. And property owners and store owners and restaurants didn't want that. They wanted very much to remain open and authentic. And so I started community organizing back then at the advice of my parents, who I have to say were quite brave. They were very different than a lot of Chinese families in that they were very outspoken. They were not fearful of government. Which was unusual because, you know, my family came over here during the time when the Chinese were very much excluded from free entry into this country during the Chinese Exclusion Act. So I think that there was a certain sense of defiance in my family that was ready to oppose these things that we didn't feel were going to be right for our neighborhood. So that was so early times of me actually organizing. And then there was an inundation at a certain point over police placard parking, where the police were taking over every single parking spot in Chinatown using their placards, fake ones, real ones. And I organized along with my brother against that. Thank you. And so that fight went on for years. You know, we were fighting literally City Hall and the NYPD. So that we would have safer streets, because they were parking in front of fire hydrants and at critical corners, and our ambulances and fire trucks weren't able to make it through. And so that was a fight that went on for years. And I actually suffered getting illegally detained and handcuffed by an undercover NYPD detective. It was not a nice experience. And I actually made it very public by going to the Village Voice, and they published a huge article about my illegal arrest. And at the time, I had a store on Mott Street. And after that article came out, I got a brick thrown through my window. And so it was scary. It was scary to have had that done to me. First of all, to be illegally detained, but also to have that warning of, like, you know, don't do that again, was really scary to me. But it didn't deter me from continuing on and working on different issues. After 9/11. Park Row, which is a major artery that connects Chinatown to the southern part of Manhattan, was closed because of potential terrorist acts. And we formed a group called the Civic Center Residents Coalition with a number of other residents and business people. And we actually brought a lawsuit against the NYPD. And that's a daunting thing to do, to bring a lawsuit against the NYPD, but we did. And we prevailed in the sense that we were able to get something called a retroactive environmental impact statement, which is very rare. And we were able to just add pressure to the government and to the NYPD to say that, you know, this street closure after all the other streets around us were opened up after 9/11, this one remained basically a parking lot for the NYPD, but it choked our community economically, physically, and very dangerously closed off the fastest route for all of us to the hospital, which is Park Row. And so it has remained closed for over two decades. And this is a fight that went on for years of my life, along with many other people who joined us. Again, my late brother was involved in that with me. And it was only until recently that our local council member, Christopher Marte, came very, very close to opening Park Row again with a pilot program. And so we're hoping that it does get restored with his help. It is something that we've been fighting for like 20 years. So, you know, these are long fights. I've been involved in some things that were years long that were not sort of the fad of the moment to get involved with. These are long, difficult, detail-oriented fights that I've been involved with many other residents. And some of them have actually resulted in having to sue the government, which is sort of a really huge endeavor when you think about it. They're expensive. You have to find lawyers that are willing to do that. But it's become kind of one of the tools in our arsenal here in Chinatown. You know, we went from being what many would say is a stereotypically docile and obedient community. You know, that's sort of a stereotype of Chinese and the Asian community as being sort of not very rebellious and very obedient and putting your head down and doing business. Actually, the opposite is true. If you look historically at Chinese in America, they've actually used the law many, many times throughout our history. And Chinatown has a history of protest, street protest. So what I do and what a lot of people that I work with do is really following in the tradition of many, many, many other pioneers. A lot of it starting from the 60s into the 70s, following along from the models of the Black Power movement and how the Chinese observed the empowerment of Black people and how they were able to challenge the government in many ways. And so my brother's generation, I'm the youngest in my family, grew up in the 60s and 70s and really had that spirit, I think, that ran through our family and certainly through me. I was opposed to something called the Business Improvement District here in Chinatown. And there are 75 plus business improvement districts throughout the city. And they're quasi-public government entities that collect real estate taxes to fund their salaries and to fund initiatives and programs within communities. In our Chinatown one, we felt that on top of all of the expenses that we have as businesses and property owners, sort of this regressive tax was not something that we felt was appropriate. But also more than that, we felt that business improvement districts hold a lot of power over land use. And they're not accountable to residents. I mean, the very fact that they're called business improvement means that they are going to be always favoring business and a lot of times corporate business. And so we felt very strongly that our residential voice would be muted if we had this other layer of bureaucracy to have to go through with regard to land use issues. I fought that fight for over 3 years. And ultimately, they prevailed, and we do have a business improvement district today. And some would even question whether or not it has efficacy or whether or not it's actually just another arm of the government that we pay taxes to clean our streets, but also oftentimes will be the loudest voice in the room when it's not necessarily the most accurate one, because it's got all this funding of over $1.5 million every year. So these are things that we have felt strongly about to push back on. And I think that issues that I've gotten involved with are really longstanding, hard issues to get involved with. But it's because of my passion for the community and how I feel that these things are winnable. Most recently, I formed, along with Christopher Marte and Howard Huey, Neighbors United Below Canal. And that was formed back in 2018, 2019, when the de Blasio administration said they want to build the tallest jail in the world here in Chinatown. And although we understood the logic behind having a jail yet again in our community, we didn't want a mega jail. We didn't want something that was overscale, that's going to dominate our community and be the largest structure here, this huge symbol of incarceration. And at the same time, after speaking with people who were formerly incarcerated, we understood that the building of gigantic jails isn't really a solution for the community or for New Yorkers, for making them safe, or most definitely not the solution for the people who are detained inside of jails. That this cycle of building gigantic jails and tearing them down and building bigger ones in their place just doesn't work for everyone. And so we have been fighting this for 5 years now. I mean, we had a huge meeting with the city last night. It was a public meeting. And, you know, again, we were left with using the law to say, we're challenging the way that you've used the land use process, and we're challenging what you've said in your documentation, and we're challenging how you're going about creating the pathway to build this mega jail. And it was a year-plus lawsuit, and it cost over $300,000 of community money that we had to raise. And we won. We actually won the lawsuit. It's an Article 78. I was one of the petitioners along with many other people. And unfortunately, the city overturned that victory. And so they won on appeal, which we felt was very politically done because de Blasio was walking out of office at the time, and the pressure that was put on city government to appeal our decision was very strong at the time because he wanted to run for higher office, and there's many other reasons. But we're still fighting that fight. You know, that's one that's gone for 5 years. It's counting. I mean, we still have the same amount of passion and unity in the community, even as of last night. And, you know, I know that after I meet with you guys, I'm getting on the phone and talking with my other colleagues to sort of do a debrief on what went on last night, because it was a very passionate, loud, sometimes raucous community meeting. And I think that our community now feels very empowered to have our voice. There was a great moment where the city said, okay, we're ready to divide you into four different groups now. We're going to move you into another room. And people in the community said, we're not moving anywhere. You're going to listen to us all together, or we're not having this meeting. And that sense of defiance in about a room of 75 people was really strong, because the government said, we're going to separate you so you can't hear each other, you can't see each other, and you don't know what each other is saying, but this is how we're going to record your voices onto paper, and that's what we're going to use as your official document to further build this jail. And the community said, no, you're not. We need to be united to hear ourselves, and people wanted to hear what the questions were that someone else had. And it was, to me, a powerful moment, because the meeting took a different tone at that moment. And interestingly enough, we've got such a unified community now. The people who ran the meeting said, we thought you were going to do this. So that shows that it's predictable in a good way. The defiance was predictable. And that's what you want in your community. You don't want them to come in and say, oh, this is an easy community, we could roll over them. So I think that those are powerful things to remember.
What do you love about your community?
Well, it is a really authentic New York City community, in the sense that, you know, this is an area that has extremely great retail diversity. It has sort of a confluence sandwiched between very expensive Tribeca and Soho, and then Wall Street to our south. It has the housing projects to our east, and the river is right near us. It's all of our subways are nearby. You know, we actually, where we're sitting is the area where like five or seven streets all come together with three different bridges and two tunnels, and so we're very accessible in Chinatown, and that makes us interesting and vulnerable at the same time, meaning that developers want to develop this area. You know, the city wants to bulldoze over the area and make big giant skyscrapers here. And so right now it is an authentic neighborhood because people actually still live in this Chinatown. And if you've been to other Chinatowns across North America, sometimes there's sort of bedroom communities where that are on the outside, and then the Chinatown part is the commerce. But we have the mix of commerce and a real neighborhood where people have schools and doctors and all of the ancillary things that you need in a real community. Eyeglass stores, you know, shoe repair stores, a laundromat. You go to certain neighborhoods in New York and you realize none of those things exist anymore. It's just the one bar, after a pizzeria, after another, you know, dollar pizza store. And sort of these communities that are centered around what we call monoculture, which is basically just everything opens at 5 o'clock and it closes at 4 o'clock and it's just centered around alcohol, whereas Chinatown is a much more diverse retail environment between restaurants and diners and dessert places and places to buy clothing and places to buy eyeglasses and going to a gynecologist or going to a senior center. These are things that create a real sense of community residency. And it's been a very diverse community, too. It's not just Chinese people who live here. There's people who are from all walks of life, all different ethnicities live in Chinatown. Although, of course, the Asian demographic is the overwhelming one. We really are a melting pot community because we're very close to Little Italy and all of that culture from there has bled over to our community, and the same for the Chinese community bleeding into the Little Italy community. I grew up here enjoying all the different foods of the Lower East Side. So, you know, even though I'm a Chinese kid going to a public school in Chinatown, there was a Kanish man who stood outside with a big smoky cart, and he had warm Kanishes in the winter. So as Chinese kids, we knew what Kanishes were. And at the same time, my Jewish friends knew how to order from a Chinese menu without a problem because they knew all the Chinese food. So did my black friends and Puerto Rican friends. And so you end up in the Lower East Side having black and Puerto Rican and Jewish friends and Chinese friends and Chinese American friends and friends from Hong Kong or friends from China, all eating and playing together as kids. And that kind of is the real beauty of what this neighborhood is, too. It's really not just a Chinese community. It's a community that's very welcoming of everybody, but you sort of, all New Yorkers find themselves in Chinatown at some point. And it's still very much a mystery, even to me, and I've been here for three generations. I'm Chinese American, but I don't speak and read Chinese. I certainly don't read Chinese, but I don't even speak it that well. So there's so much more to Chinatown that I don't even know about. And I think that there's a part of that mystery that's really intriguing, even as a resident. You could live in Chinatown your whole life and probably not know everything there is to know about Chinatown. There's Cantonese opera, and there's Beijing opera, and there's softball teams and basketball teams, and there's artist groups, and there's new artist groups, and book readings, and all of these things that are very unique to just us, contextual to us. So it's impossible to learn everything, and I think that that's the really fun part. People who come down and go, I know the 10 best dumpling places. No, you don't. You know, I know where to get the best. No, you don't. That's not possible. I'm sorry. It's so subjective about what is the best of anything, because if you're Cantonese, you'll have a very strong viewpoint about what Cantonese food is. If you're from another part of China, and by the way, China's really huge. It's not one dialect group. There's many different minorities in China. So people are opening different types of businesses here. So to say that you know the best of something in Chinatown is bullshit. That's not possible. And I think that it's also kind of dangerous to say, to walk into any neighborhood. I would never go to Harlem and say, I know the best place to get a dish. It's up to everybody's viewpoint of what the context is of what that dish is, or what their life experience has led them, you know, to different food experiences. So it's an interesting place for that. You know, people like to kind of categorize us. They like to talk about different things about Chinatown, but it's too big. Even though it's geographically a small place, it's culturally a really big place. Those are the things I love about it.
You first became actively involved in community work.
The moment that I first became active in community work, I was actually quite young. I was, as I said, in my 20s, and my parents were both interested in getting me involved in helping them coalesce around fighting against Chinatown becoming sort of a suburban mall. And property owners and business owners didn't want that. But there was no real vehicle. There was no unified way of getting them together. And so literally going door to door saying, what do you feel about them turning Chinatown into this pedestrian mall like the suburbs? And people are like, no, I don't want that. And so we organized around that. And it was successful. You know, it was during the Koch administration. There was a lot of self-interested developer money behind it, where they wanted to sort of privatize all of the things involved in the street design and the lighting and even the pavers. And so we rejected that. And I'm glad that we did, because Chinatown was able to evolve and be very authentic. And it's still the way you see it today, because it didn't become a pedestrian mall.
What success do you remember most vividly and why?
As I said earlier, you know, we were one of the groups that actually sued the New York City Police Department for taking over our Park Row, one of the major arteries that connects Chinatown to the southern part of Manhattan. And people looked at us and said, "You're crazy. You can't fight City Hall." And I'm living testament to tell you, you certainly can fight City Hall. And you know, the environmental impact statement that we were able to get really revealed a lot about how heavy-handed the NYPD was at the time, and Homeland Security was really on hyper alert, and a lot of those things were sort of contrived, because many, many other sensitive areas in New York, including the street in front of the UN or the street in front of the FBI building, were all opened up. And so we succeeded in getting that lawsuit out there. You know, we were successful in suing the city when they tried to force this mega jail down our throats. We, at great expense, spent a lot of money and a lot of effort in Chinatown to create a lawsuit in Article 78, which we were successful in. First time ever. First time that anybody ever brought a lawsuit against the city for building a jail. First time that we won a lawsuit against the city of New York, because it was overturned. But the history is that we won a lawsuit trying to stop something that we didn't feel was being correctly processed through the neighborhood. And those are big things. Fighting City Hall, fighting against the building of a mega jail, fighting against the closure of a street. And they're big entities. The NYPD is a massive organization. And so is the Criminal Justice Department of the City of New York.
What thoughts or advice do you have for young community organizers or workers? And what strategies do you suggest for getting more involved in community work?
Realistic about what the issues are that you want to change, and be realistic about what your expectations are. It's great to have really large goals, but the fights that I've been involved with are years long in some cases. So you have to have your eye on the ball. But as you community organize, you have to be surrounded by people that really have the stamina and the willingness to get very deep into details, so that when you speak, you're speaking from an intelligent, well-researched point of view, and try to empathize with your opposition to understand how they're going to view what you're saying. But most importantly, I think if you have your own community's heart and passion behind you, you can get a lot done. The key is to not be the fad of the moment or the issue of the moment or something that's going to just lose steam quickly. And we've seen that across the city and across the nation, where you'll see this trend happen and everybody's talking about that one thing. But it's often because the leadership doesn't have the people behind them with the true education about what the issue is, so that they could continue to fight and continue to be educated about it and then pass the baton to someone else. I think, as is often said, when you take a leadership role, you have to understand how you're going to extricate yourself and pass it on to someone else, and don't think that you're going to carry the ball for the entire time. You have to have really good partners. You have to be well researched and always have a solution. It is not enough when you're dealing with the government to say, I don't want this. Every neighborhood says they don't want something. But you'll get much farther if you have a reasonable solution that can at least be met halfway. And that opens the door to actually having the conversation with the government. The government hears every single day that someone in some neighborhood doesn't want something. And they like that because they don't really have to address you any more than just some superficial issue. But if you bring up solutions and you say, well, there are solutions. Here's one that sounds good to us. Here's another one. Here's a third one. Let's sit down and really talk about how to get to these solutions in an intelligent way. Or else we'll protest, or else we'll call you out, and we'll talk about those solutions and how they're better and how you're not willing to talk about these solutions. So I think it's great when people defy the government and say that this is not going to work for us. But you also have to understand where the government's coming from, what is the true cause of what they want to do, and then rally behind your solution. It also, when you have solution-based answers, your movement lasts longer. Because if you go to the government and you get 8 or 10 people behind you and stand in front of and protest or do a press conference, if you don't have a solution, you yourself are not going to be able to sustain the stamina that it takes to get what you want done. So I think that's, for me, it's been a real eye-opener to surround yourself with older people who have fought fights in New York, who can tell you, when we were out in the streets, this is what we did. And more times than not, if they feel that your issue is strong, I've had 70, 80-year-old people in Chinatown that were once young that said, I'm going to join your fight again. And they'll bring that spirit. But really importantly is that they bring knowledge. And they bring the techniques that they used to get things done in their neighborhood before. And so there's a great variety in the best community groups, which is young and old, diversity, and a lot of viewpoints that can come together around a solution. That tends to be the thing that keeps people together.
Are there particular people who have influenced or inspired your activism / your work?
I would say that it starts from my grandfather, although I didn't know him. He unfortunately passed away before I was born, but his spirit and the way that he really decided at some point in his life as a young man that he would put down roots in New York permanently and that he would raise his family here, that was really in defiance of a government that didn't want him here. You know, the Chinese Exclusion Act was real. It happened in New York, it happened in America and Canada simultaneously. And when you do everything you can to exist in a country that actually doesn't want you to be here, that is defiant. And, you know, being a property owner at some time in his life that, you know, we still occupy the building and manage the building that he bought in the 1920s, we're almost 100 years in the same ownership. In many ways is that long-lasting symbol of defiance, of saying, you didn't want us here, but we're here, and we actually put down roots here, and we own a part of New York. And we're helping immigrant families for 100 years establish themselves in this country. And that's actually the inspiration, I think, about that legacy and what it speaks for is really strong in my family. You know, my late brother Jeff Lee was very community minded. He was also involved in the arts as I am, and it's that great sort of spirit of defiance that really helps us organize around issues that we feel are dangerous or feel are detrimental to our community. And so my parents also embodied a lot of that, very different than some of their peers. They were not afraid of, you know, writing letters or organizing around issues that they felt were going to be dangerous or detrimental to their own business. And I think that that, again, shows that they passed down that idea to me, that it's like, it's not, you don't have to be afraid. So I think that that's something that I like to pass on to other people. As far as the latest issues that I'm working on, the best place to find information about the opposition to the mega jail in Chinatown is Neighbors United Below Canal. Our website is nubcnyc.com. It's a very extensive website with neighborhood testimony and great information for students, what the jail is, why is it not acceptable for our community, but also what are the alternatives to a mega jail. And so I think anybody that wants to do information and research on criminal justice reform and architecture and land use, it's a great website for that. So we also have newsletters that are published regularly, so it's a great way to catch up and join our mailing list.